mapping of different wheels and discs so that, and it was electrical, not electronic, that a particular value would be routed. These wheels would have cross connects for all their pads and connection points, and then the rotation of the wheel so that you would go from, like, you know, 0.1 to 0.20, and then you jump over to the next wheel and go from 20 to 13, and then jump to the next wheel 13 to 17. All these, the what was what each wheel's connections were, and what the alignment of the wheels was, were all variables. And so that code was partially cracked, but they never had a general cracking mechanism for that back in World War II. So that was probably one of the best. Okay, so a little review here. We'll go through these quickly. Steganography is the oldest. The modern version is embedding into JPG pictures or GIF pictures. JPGs are a lot easier. Actually, GIFs are easier because they're static. They don't get compressed, so you have a plain value. But the thing is, that is one of the oldest ones and still quite useful. But the one thing about steganography is it just hides it. It doesn't obfuscate it in any way. If you know where to look for the data, it's there. So that's one of the differences about steganographic cryptography, is that if you know where to look, you will find the answer. There's no, once you figure out that, you've got it. The substitution codes, if you ever read the Dancing Men, Sherlock Holmes story, that was a substitution code. If you're old enough, a Captain Video Secret Decoder Ring. Those are also values of this. So the thing is, but it's easy to break. And there is one substitution code that was never broken. And that was the Navajo code talkers during World War II. The thing that they did is they made it polyalphabetic, because the thing is, if they wanted to use the letter A, they would use different words, apple, ant, you know, ant, your parents' sibling. And so all of those words were different in Navajo. Nobody except the Navajos knew how to speak Navajo. And since those words translated from English into Navajo didn't all start with A, it was very confusing. And in fact, that is the only substitution code that to anyone's knowledge was never broken. And that was used extensively during World War II, because they could speak it over the radio. Okay, book codes, I think we talked about, I think enough on that. The one-time pads, again, it's a substitution code, but it's done with a string of random numbers, and it's totally excellent if you can keep the pad secret. So the production of the pad is the hard part. No, that would be another way to do it. I mean, the thing is, if you had enough spare, if you didn't care if the FPGA was functional and just sent that as a load, that would work.
I mean, what I've seen is, like, the hardware for image processing to extract the information embedded in the FPGA bitstream along with that image file in the vectorized form of the image file.
Okay. Yeah, that would work. Another method of cryptography. Cool. I mean, I'm not aware of it, but it certainly sounds like it could be done.
Sounds like it'd be hard to break. I'm not sure.
Potentially, yeah. That's the whole thing, is that until you start, one thing about all the cryptography, a lot of different cryptographic algorithms are developed all the time. People think they're clever. And they come up with new algorithms, and it's really quite astonishing how few crypto algorithms are actually good. There's a gentleman I've known for 35 years, and he's a PhD in crypto. He has a PhD in mathematics and has worked in cryptography his entire career. He has produced probably 25 crypto algorithms, and none of them have survived. Every single one of them was cracked within a couple of weeks. And on the other hand, the team who did a crypto algorithm called Mars, which was another one of the AES candidates that was not accepted, was all, there were some of the people on that team who also did DES. And these guys are, on the other hand, they have done crypto algorithms for 25 years, and none of them have ever been found to have a flaw. So some people get it, some people don't. The AES algorithm, which was originally called Rindel, which was developed, I believe, in Sweden, that team also, you know, to anyone's knowledge so far, there are no flaws in the algorithm, but that was a little bit computationally more efficient. So that was one of the reasons that it was chosen. There were, I think, there were dozens of original candidates, and they got down to three or four, and then there was Serpent, Mars, and Rindel, I know, were of the last ones. Serpent came from University of Cambridge in England, and Serpent was written in Python, which was one of the reasons, bad joke. But those algorithms were all deemed to be acceptable as far as hardness, but AES was chosen because it was the most computationally efficient. Okay, so now we get into the mathematical and mechanical manipulation. So this is modern cryptography. This is where we are today. There are a bunch of what are called symmetric key algorithms, and we'll talk about the difference between symmetric key and public key in a minute. AES is the one we're most familiar with. DES was the former former choice, but it turned out that there wasn't a flaw in DES. It just had too few combinations, and as computing power increased, we were able to crack it. Triple DES, which is a three-loop iteration of DES using different keys, is still considered acceptable. It's hard enough that breaking that is not considered a significant risk, and therefore triple DES is still allowed to be used in CMVP validated FIPS 140 modules. RC4 is another old algorithm that's long since bit the dust, and I repeated AES, so I have a typo in here. Public key algorithms, the two most popular are RSA, Ravesh-Shamir-Aleman, the three letters of the three gentlemen who invented it, and elliptical curve cryptography, which is another method that has some advantages computationally. And so that's, on the other hand, it appears to be very weak for quantum computing, so that it's losing favor. But, okay, there are a whole bunch of others, but let's start with these. So again, in World War II, polyalphabetic substitution, mechanical rotors, and Enigma were the best crypto we had. That was really just before computing. So then crypto helped start modern computing, because in fact computing was originally used to try to crack crypto. So before they were using computing to encrypt, they were trying to use computers to decrypt, not knowing, you know, because they figured computers could try more keys in a shorter period of time than people did, which was true. And since a lot of this now comes down to just mathematical brute force, that helped spur computers because they were useful for breaking codes, and that helped win wars. So these led to breakthroughs in computing because people realized how to improve the performance of computers. So the first major modern algorithms were symmetric block or stream ciphers. And so they can be used, they're primarily used for secrecy. We'll see when we start talking about message authentication codes or MACs that they can also be used for integrity checking. But primarily DES, which was developed in the 70s, was the first commercial quality cipher. And to this day, it's still, no one's ever found anything wrong with it, although there have been many people who truly believe that the design of part of the algorithm was that there were back doors left in it, and many people have done PhD theses on trying to find these back doors, and no one has been successful. But the main thing about DES is, being a symmetric algorithm, you have a string of bits, which is a key, and you apply that with a mathematical algorithm to plain text, which is your original message, and you get out a ciphertext. And then you use the same key to decrypt the data later. So it's symmetrical. You use the same key to encrypt and decrypt. And that is the fundamental property of symmetric algorithms. The other thing is they also tend to be pretty computationally efficient. So although you have this risk of having to transport the key, you still end up with very good cryptography at a fairly low computational cost. So right now the only known attack is brute force. Now what happened to DES is since the actual key size, they said it was 64 bits. Is it really only 56 bits? Because 8 bits were used for parity as an integrity check on the key. And so what happened is, and I believe it was 2002, I was sitting in the audience at RSA when this was announced, that in less than 24 hours, a brute force attack had been successful on DES, and that was the day that DES died. Because when they realized, the attack was done by, I wouldn't call them amateurs, but it was done by a bunch of people who had, the Electronic Frontier Foundation had helped finance the building of a machine called DeepCrack, which had, I think, 64K DES engines in it, plus a group called Distributed.net invited people to let others use their machines for computational power when they were on screensaver. So if you loaded the software into your machine, whenever you weren't using it, it sent out and said, okay, I'm free now, and that would give it DES samples to try to crack. So that the combination of these two together were able to split up the DES key space and within less than 24 hours crack DES keys. And that was the mechanism that they used, so we had to get better after that. So just for historical purposes, because this is still very relevant, that is the block diagram of DES. And kind of the most important part is, in each of these functions, there's a substitution and that's called the S-box. And that's the data coming in is mixed with key bits and put through basically a memory, so that you put so many bits in, you get so many bits out, and they're different. It's just a mapping. And that was the fundamental thing that made DES interesting. Of course, they use XORs and ANDs and ORs and other mathematical functions to combine the bits, but the mapping of the S-box was really what made DES DES, and it's still used in AES today. But the thing is, the formation of DES using that technique was what was the beginning of modern cryptography, and if we didn't have computers as powerful as we do, it would still be completely valid. So you can crank this up a little bit. Triple DES simply uses DES three times by you encrypt, you decrypt, and you encrypt again, and you basically now have up to 168-bit key, 56 times 3. But the main thing is to do it so that those keys are used effectively, you have to use a different key for each of the three operations. So for example, if you use the same key all three times, you're only getting the effect of encrypting with the one key, because it encrypts under it, decrypts under it, you get your plain text back, you encrypt the second time, and you end up just with a single encryption. If you use two-key triple DES, which was commonly used for a while, you use one key encrypt, a different key decrypt, and then the first encrypt key again. That works, but doesn't give you the full strength. But if you use a different key for each of the three, you get the full strength. And that is considered still good to this day. There are a lot of, especially in finance. What happens in finance is they were very, very slow to adopt advances in cryptography. In fact, I was giving this first hour of the talk I used to give to banking groups where the management would come in because they didn't know anything about cryptography and they had to deal with it. So I was giving this talk at a conference, and long about this time, in the older version, I was saying, DES is dead, we're now going to be switching to AES. And a guy in the back of the room actually came running up and was going to physically attack me. He had to be restrained, because he thought that my making that statement was going to kill the entire banking business. So banks, there are cases of where banks had 10,000 ATMs, all keyed with the very same DES key, single DES key, and the key was not changed for over 10 years. And every one of those ATMs also had an IBM PS2 Model 70 PC inside of them running the game. So that's gives you the date. So this goes back to the late 80s. But the thing is, these guys didn't think that anything ever needed to change. They didn't think anyone was ever going to be able to mount an effective attack against any of this stuff. And when they were told that they had to start modernizing, they resisted strongly, and to this day they still resist strongly, because that's why the U.S. is still primarily on chip and signature instead of chip and PIN.
As far as the ATMs are concerned, who's critically to blame there? The manufacturer, which is typically Diebold, or the people that are buying them?
Yeah, they were. Diebold was definitely one of the main culprits. There were a couple others, but the thing is, the banks got used to that and didn't want it to change, because they liked being able for every field service technician to have the key and to be able to do anything, fix anything at any time. And so what happened was, it was still an amazingly complex change in finance 15 years ago, when they realized they had to actually start doing things right. It was pretty scary, because I used to work in finance back then. I used to design HSMs. Yeah. In fact, here in the wonderful world of FIPS 140, I'm sure that there are those of you who've had to take modules through in the last year or two, where you used to sign your code with SHA-1 and an RSA signature, and you had to switch to SHA-2, and that was extremely painful. I know in some cases it took over a year, because the whole worldwide build process had to be revamped to do that. And it was expensive, especially because people always want to be able to downgrade. But yeah, so that's another one that's the same, been causing the same kinds of problems. So now we all use AES at 128 or 256 bits, because for the foreseeable future there isn't enough computing power to do a brute force attack against that. RC4 was another one that was very commonly used for web stuff, along with MD5 back in the early SSL days, but they're all gone now. So the basic way encryption works is, you take a message, you take a key, you run it through the encryption process, and you get out what looks like junk. You send the message anywhere you want, you send the key by an out of band process. You don't send the key in the same message with the message. And then, using the key and the reverse process to decrypt, you get your message back. And that's the basis of modern block cryptography. And we're going to see how all the things, when we start talking about crypto protocols, you're going to start seeing how valuable that is. So then there's public key. This is the new thing, or the newer thing. The main thing about public key algorithms is that your key has two separate pieces. There's the public part you let everybody see, and there's the private part you don't let anybody see. Now, the cool thing about that is, and this happens every time you buy something on the internet, your public key is sent along or kept on the server, and we'll talk about PKI and certificate authorities and things like that a little later, that you encrypt a message with your private key, and someone can look up your public key and decrypt it. That guarantees, and we'll talk again, non-repudiation. If it decrypts correctly, you're the only person who could have sent it, unless you shared your secret key, which you shouldn't have. And it allows you to share information with people without giving them any knowledge about your secrets. So, but the problem is that public key algorithms, and we'll talk more about this in a minute, they're computationally very expensive. So the thing is, you don't want to encrypt large amounts of data using a public key algorithm. So typically what you do is you encrypt a symmetric key algorithm and send that, symmetric key and send that. And then you encrypt your data with a symmetric key algorithm and send the message over, they decrypt the key, and then that allows them to decrypt the data. So RSA, Ravesh Shamir Edelman, three nice guys, they're the ones who invented RSA. It's still the most popular public key algorithm. It works, there's no weaknesses. There are, again, strengths. Its strength, since it requires prime numbers to work, basically factoring to produce the primes that produce the key is the way you crack it. Factoring is very, very hard computationally. So it's turned out to be a good algorithm. Typically, the strengths used these days are 2048, 3072, and 4096 bits, with 2048 bits being the most popular. Elliptic curve cryptography is interesting because you can play with the curve, and I won't go into all the details. The mathematical details get real messy real fast, and I'll be honest, I'm not even sure I can do a good job of explaining them. If you would like, there's some references at the end of the talk. You can go look them up in textbooks where you may spend an entire day or two just looking at that. But the advantage, one big advantage of ECC is the fact that you can tailor which end uses more computation. So for example, the big deal with ECC 15 years ago, before smartphones, was when people used to carry pagers. Pagers had little teeny tiny processors, but the paging message was typically sent out by a mainframe. So they would be able to use a curve that took all the computational force to encrypt the message, but very little to decrypt it. So the thing is, you can have big old mainframes sending out millions and millions of text messages very quickly, and then little tiny pagers in your pocket that were able to decrypt the message sent to you just as quickly. And so that's one of the advantages. Now, as it turns out, when we look at elliptic curve now, we tend to talk about the NIST curves that we all use that are approved by the CMVP for use in FIPS modules, and they're pretty symmetrical as far as computational resource needed to encrypt and decrypt. And the thing is, it turns out that for quantum computing, they're pretty easy. They're expecting that quantum computers will be able to crack ECC pretty easily. So ECC is kind of in an iffy state these days. RSA seems to not be as susceptible. Factoring is not one of the strengths of quantum, at least so far as they've discovered uses for it. So that's one of the reason that, okay, the NSA and NIST had been pushing back and actually took the 4096-bit RSA off the approved list about 5 years ago, trying to push everybody into ECC for higher security. As of about a year ago, where they're pulling back on their support for ECC, the RSA 4096 is once again allowed and suggested for certain uses. So right now, RSA is still in pretty good shape. An RSA 4096-bit computation is expensive, but so far everyone believes that it's still quite secure. So again, public key algorithms are computationally intensive. You don't want to encrypt large amounts of data, so you use a good block algorithm like AES, and then all you do is encrypt the key using public key cryptography and send that. And so, yeah, basic public key encryption is you take a message, you encrypt it, and notice I'm encrypting it with the public key. I'm going backwards. It works either way. And you get out the message, and then you use the other key to recover the message. And the nice thing about it is you can go both ways on that. So it makes RSA even more valuable. Someone can use your public key to encrypt a message to you that only you can read, or you can encrypt a message using someone's public key, or you can encrypt a message using your private key that they use your public key to get. So the thing is, you're always maintaining your privacy and your secrecy of your private key, but you can, by the use of your keys, you can either broadcast or target. And that's where the value of these algorithms are. Okay, so step away from encryption for a second and talk about hash algorithms. They're used for integrity verification. Basically, what a hash does is you take an entire file or chunk of data, you run it through a hash algorithm, and you get a small value back. And that small value is a stamp that says, if you run this through here, you're going to get this. And any change at all to your data results in the hash being different. And hash algorithms are chosen for what's called an avalanche factor, that even small changes in the data make large changes in the output. And so that's what makes hash algorithms valuable. They're a fingerprint. You can't recover the data, but you can always guarantee that it's the same. So the thing is, hash algorithms are basically one-way encryption algorithms, and all you care about is the last block of output. And so they guarantee that your data is, you know, when you, and this is most commonly used now, for example, like if you want to get a new firmware version for your router for your Wi-Fi router at home, you download it. You can download a program off the internet that checks the hash and verifies that the code you're about to load into your router is actually the version that you mean to. And then a lot of better hardware now actually does that checking. If it's FIPS validated, it'll have to do that checking before it'll allow the code to load at all. So for example, all of the equipment made by the company I work for, Aruba, all of our code updates are SHA-2 hashed and then signed with a RSA 2048-bit key. That signature is embedded in the code. When it goes along, they use the public factory key, and redo the hash to make sure that the code that we're sending is exactly the code that we sent, that the code we're receiving is what we sent. So that's become a standard thing, and that's required under FIPS 140 now. SHA is the most common used family of hash algorithms we use these days. So now that we've got public key cryptography, block cipher cryptography, and hashing, what can we do? What do these tools give us? Okay, so we can of course send secret messages. We can hash the files and prove their integrity. We can send a secret key using a public key algorithm. And we can enable non-repudiation using public-private keys. So this gives us this really big toolkit. And so now what we do is we take these tools and we use them to develop protocols. Protocols are combinations of cryptographic algorithms used for specific purposes. And so we can do even more useful things by combining all these. So we combine basic crypto building blocks to create powerful tools. We use multiple algorithms so we can do complicated things, stuff that any one of these algorithms would be no good at doing or not sufficient to produce the features we want. But we can combine these algorithms and get it. And the thing is, the most important thing is that the protocol is good. Okay, back before I talked about, you know, a friend of mine who'd done 20 crypto algorithms and every one of them had been cracked at some point. He just didn't get it. Well, protocols are just as easy to mess up as algorithms are. In fact, they're kind of easier to mess up because everyone thinks, oh, well, I'm not going to mess with the crypto. I'm just going to, you know, pile them together. And this looks good, right, for a protocol, doesn't it? It's great. Yeah. Well, no. Almost every protocol, even the most carefully evaluated ones, they find holes or flaws eventually. Crypto's complicated. And I'll say that a bunch of times today. It is not, it's mathematically complicated. It's logistically complicated. You need to fit everything together in a way that doesn't leave any holes. You have to, you know, leave a smooth wall up when you're done. You know, that's your protection, that there are no chinks in the wall, there's no cracks, there's no little holes where someone can sneak through. And so this is a personal recommendation: never trust anyone's proprietary protocol. A lot of people think that, in fact, voting systems are probably one of the most terrible examples of crappy security in the United States, because we do not have all the states, because of states' rights, get to choose their own voting systems. And in some states, every county gets to choose their own voting system. And there are a number of companies, back to Diebold again too, who make voting systems, and they are simply garbage. None of them use validated cryptography. Most of them use really poor obfuscation techniques. The integrity technique used by one of the companies is CRC32, which is kind of a forerunner to the hash algorithm and was kind of used in the old days to make sure very simple files didn't lose their integrity when being written to and read back from a cassette tape, if you're old enough to remember what a cassette tape is. So that's an example of people who dream up their own protocols, think they're being clever, and leave stuff so wide open any kid with a high school degree can usually crack their security. In fact, they don't even need a high school education. They just have to be clever. So don't trust proprietary protocols. Use the ones that have RFCs and are well accepted. Then again, if you're doing things for FIPS 140, you have to use approved functions. And if you're doing stuff for common criteria, you must use approved protocols. So that tends to help a lot, but it's pretty amazing. Okay. So let's see what time we've been going for an hour and 20 minutes. Okay, we're going to go. He said, okay, Bill said 10:30. 10:15. Okay, so we've got about another half hour. Is everyone all right, or we need a 5-minute break? I know this stuff is easy to, I put people to sleep really well with this. If you want a recording for helping you get to sleep, we can arrange that. Okay, we'll go to 10:15. Okay, so Secure Sockets Layer, SSL, was probably the first major crypto protocol that everyone in this room dealt with. And you dealt with it primarily connecting to stuff on the web. And it's originally how most web transactions, you know, when you bought things on the web, how it was done. It still is in some cases, which is still scary. And so basically, you use a random number generator to create a secret. The common term for that is nonce. I'm just going and grabbing a handful of random bits. I look up the public key of a host, Amazon, and I can encrypt that nonce and send it over. And so now we share a secret, because they can decrypt it, because they have the other end of the certificate. I encrypted it with their public key, they decrypt it with their private key, so now we share a secret. By an exchange process, we create a session key, which allows us to then encrypt our traffic back and forth, so that anyone looking at it won't be able to see what the real data is, like my credit card number, or your credit card number, or, you know, your PIN, or whatever. And so, you also use a hash algorithm to verify the integrity of all the data going back and forth, because in the early days of the internet, no one believed that the bits all got there. So, wonderful. This works. This was a great first start. But the problem is, we only validated the server, not the client. And by doing that, we allowed a thing called man in the middle. Let's say someone was really clever and they hijacked the source of internet addresses you get, called your dynamic name server, your DNS. So you go to Amazon, you go to the hijacked DNS and it says, oh me, I'm Amazon. And they go to Amazon for you and they return the page to your address. They're middlemanning all your data. So then what happens is you go to buy something. And so what happens is you have an SSL session to the middleman. The middleman has an SSL session in your name to Amazon. So what happens is you put your credit card number in. They decrypt it. Oh, boy, I got a credit card number. Re-encrypt it and send it along. They let your transaction complete perfectly. They might. They might break it in the middle and say, oops, sorry, it didn't work. Try again another time. But they usually let it complete. But then now they have all your information. So sometime later, 1 millisecond, 4 weeks, happened to me just last week, because it was done by a person, not by a computer. They take all your information and they go buy things as you. And your credit card bill comes back weird, or your credit card company notices it's not from your address or something and sends you a fraud notice. But now we have TLS, and just as, by the way, just as an interesting thing, I was in Europe 2 weeks ago for the CC meeting, and my credit card got skimmed. Somebody, presumably the only place this could have been was at the hotel I was staying, because they had my credit card number, the expiration date, the security number, and they had my address, because I had to check into the hotel and give them my identification. So then they went on the web and tried to pretend they were me and buy things. So the good part was, is since their starting location wasn't where I normally live, the credit company said, wait, that's a little weird, and sent me a text going, here's a PIN for your transaction if this is really you. And then a minute later, I got another thing saying, this is a fraud notification. We don't like the way that one looks. And then I sent back saying, yep, that looks bad. And 10 seconds later, my phone rings, and now I have a new card in my pocket. But that's another reason why the chip and PIN card is so good, where you never hand your card to the people doing the transaction. That way they never get to know the number or your security code or the expiration date. And that way they wouldn't have been able to do it. But this was one of the places, because I had an American card that still required a signature, I had to hand them the card. So another reason why chip and PIN's a good thing, where you never left the card out of your hand. But for over the web, TLS is another way of doing it, because it's bidirectional. So what it amounts to is, you have a certificate, your endpoint, Amazon, has a certificate, you each look up the other's public key, and you crisscross. And by doing that, there can't be a man in the middle, because his certificate's not going to show, unless you pickled the what's called a certificate authority, and we'll talk about those in a minute. But the thing is, by going to a bidirectional authentication system, you've gotten rid of the possibility of man in the middle, which has always been one of the most risky attacks with all these protocols. So that's why TLS is an improved version. It gets rid of a particular kind of attack that was really easy to do and very common. But we're going to step aside for a second and talk about PKI, public key infrastructure. You hear a lot about it. You hear about digital certificates, certificate authorities. Like, for example, you know, if you want to have a good certificate, you go to one of the trust companies and they generate a certificate for you, or you generate, actually, the right way is it's generated on your machine and they get the public key. They don't get the private key. You know, no one ever has that but you. But the thing is, you go through this process by which it's generated, and it's all vetted. And so you now have a certificate in your machine, and you have the private, they have the public, so does Amazon, all this. So doing stuff like this TLS should all be pretty trivial. But PKI is a concept. It's not a thing. And there are a lot of people who are trying to make this thing. None of them are approved, really tested, checked, anything. It's just kind of evolved that using the certificate authorities that issue certificates has become standard, because that's allowed internet commerce to move forward and flourish. But it's still not the end-all be-all, and there's still a tremendous number of holes in it, and basically no one waited. So understand that when your company starts talking about things like PKI, or you're going through common criteria and you have to do certificate verification and climb an OCSP chain, we'll talk about that a little later too, these things are all still works in progress, and none of them are really rock solid yet. So like I said, it's a concept, not a thing. They can be, PKIs can be used to develop and perform remote key management and distribution. That's the holy grail. But like Monty Python, the quest continues. So right now we've got the way we do it, it works. Each certificate authority has their own structure and their own hierarchical set of responders that will do key checking, that will do validation, but all of this is still pretty ad hoc. All right, so enough of my soapboxing for the moment. Let's go back to SSL and TLS. Okay, so we talked about them. That was really just a way I could stuff my PKI statements in there for you. So let's talk about how this stuff works. Okay, SSL. Basically, I open up a session request. I send HTTPS for secure, or somewhat secure. I send that. The server, I look up the server's public key, that gets sent back to me. I authenticate that certificate against a CA. Again, I'm trusting the cloud. If I've been misdirected, I may believe a key that I shouldn't. But in general, those have been fairly okay. There haven't been too many of those because it's a fairly hard thing to misdirect everyone's internet routing. And then lastly, so now I sent my nonce up. I encrypted my nonce under the server, under the certificate's public key. I send it up. We share a secret. We negotiate a session key. We talk. It works. But again, it's subject to the man in the middle stuff I talked about before. TLS is bidirectional. So notice, in addition to this first part, which is what happened during SSL, I also have this part where I have to send the client certificate. So I'm doing the same process that I just made the server did. The server's making me do that. I authenticate myself with my certificate. And by doing that, I can then negotiate everything, have my data, and then close the session. And so the advantage to TLS is the certification, the authentication goes in both directions. I am reasonably sure that the person I'm talking to is who I think it is, and they are reasonably sure that I am who I say I am. And that is, in general, now how your web transactions run. And there have been several versions of all this stuff, and we're TLS 1.0 and 1.0 is gone. 1.1 should be gone. 1.2 is pretty much what we're running on now. And 1.3 is chasing along. Okay, so SSL is unidirectional. The server validates itself to the client. TLS is bidirectional. Both the client and server validate themselves to each other. And the idea is it prevents identity spoofing. And that way, when you get done with your credit card, you actually get the things you ordered from Amazon instead of somebody else getting your credit card information. Yes, I mean, you can stage a man-in-the-middle attack. There are ways to do that if your TLS is implemented properly, no, you can no longer do that. Now, I guess there are, if you completely, basically, if you take over the entire universe and you can completely fake the server end, certificate authority, everything. Yeah, you could presumably do that, but basically, that's hard enough because you basically pickled the internet at that point, or at least your little corner of the internet. That no, it's people generally don't consider that, especially the fact that there are ways to get around it, and that's if you store the public keys, and that way you can't be fed the wrong one, and you don't. There's some people, okay, back to PKI, how you handle stuff. Like, for example, in SMI mail, you give the other person your key. There's still ways to get in the middle of this too, but the thing is, you give the other person your public key by signing a message. You can do stuff like that and distribute, you know, the part of PKI that is the key distribution, and we tend to use that as automatic these days. But the thing is, if you end up holding copies of your server's public key, public key side, then you know only that server can decrypt it. So the thing is, there are ways to beat the man in the middle completely. As soon as when you're using an open CA, if someone can subvert your DNS, yeah, they can potentially, you know, substitute a certificate, but that's real hard. And if either of you two guys disagree with me, please pipe up and tell me. You're still awake, so I'm doing something wrong.
Well, I mean, so some files to replace CAs.
Right. Okay. Next, so we had SSL, so now we have SSH. Now, this is a secure terminal program. For those of you who are only Windows users, you're probably not terribly familiar with this. But for people who use pretty much any other X type of operating system, it's a way that you open up a terminal in another system, and it's again a lot. It looks a lot like SSL for the communication. You can use a password or a certificate, but the main thing is, again, like SSL, like TLS, I kind of neglected at the top, when you first start an SSL or TLS session, you start by negotiating a version and a crypto suite. You agree on what you agree on what version of the protocol you're going to use and what your crypto algorithms are going to be. Same thing with SSH. That's the first start. You always have to agree, because the thing is, you can use a bunch of different algorithms and you can use a bunch of different key sizes, and each of those, of course, if you're not talking the same one, you're not going to understand what the other is saying. So again, with SSH, you start by opening the session, negotiating the version, and then the authentication, and then finally you create a tunnel for the data to pass back and forth. And very similar to SSL, you discuss all the versions, you do all your algorithms, then you do a similar kind of key exchange, you develop the shared secret and create session keys, you finish a key exchange, and then you start, and then it looks just like, you know, a terminal, for those of you who are used to using SSH, or if you use the command line in Windows, It looks like that. And so, but the thing is, it's a completely encrypted tunnel, so none of your data shows, none of the return data shows. It's the normal way people manage systems. And so this is another protocol that is very commonly used and is most end users don't use this much, but of course, for system administration, this is probably the most common way people talk to systems. So that's changing too, because what we've been seeing in the last several years is used to be that hardcore computer people disdained GUIs. I don't do GUIs. I type. I want the CLI, command line interface. What's especially network guys, router people who set up routers and switches, if you tell them to use the GUI, they spit on you. But finally, we're getting enough people in who grew up doing with graphical interfaces. So, and I guess I must have been an early adopter because I've always thought that typing was terrible. So I like clicking, much easier, with fewer mistakes. So SSH is still popular as a, it's commonly used as the interface of last resort. Like if you've messed up the system and can't get to it, this is the way you get into the back end and fix things. But SSH is still quite popular and still used for management in a lot of places. Okay, now we get to the most complicated one, which is IPsec. And for those of you who really understand this, please forgive me. I'm not going into all the wonderful depth of what IPsec is, can do, and how it goes, because I'll probably do an inadequate job for the people who really understand and confuse everyone who doesn't. So let's just say that IPsec is a way to create a tunnel, secure tunnel between two points. Now, they may be networks, they may be computers, they may be appliances, but the important part is that once you've established an IPsec tunnel, it's just like connecting to something on your network, except everything going back and forth is secure. And so this makes this one of the most useful protocols. One of the other things this is sometimes used for is VPN, virtual private network. There are other protocols commonly used for that as well, but an IPsec tunnel is considered the gold standard for a VPN connection. And that allows you, in fact, a lot of you may be using an IPsec connection when you're logging in to your work site from home. And that guarantee, this is really the most secure of connections. So the thing is, again, there's a lot of negotiation. First, you have to agree on the crypto suite, the authentication, and then you establish the tunnel. The negotiation authentication are usually handled by IKE, Internet Key Exchange. So that's usually the first step in IPsec, is running up IKE and generating your keys. Then, once you develop the connection, you really have two choices here. You've got authentication header and encapsulated security payload. AH is not used that much. It's really an integrity verification, but not secrecy. The data still flows in plain text, but it's authenticated and integrity checked. The kind that we're most familiar with is ESP, encapsulating security payload, but so not only is authentication and integrity checking performed, but also the data is encrypted. And then there are even two more kinds of that. So the two modes for ESP, there's tunnel mode, where they basically take the entire IP packet that you're sending, headers, all the mess, all the information about the data, as well as the data, and that goes through the tunnel. Or transport mode, where you're basically only encrypting the data, but all the IP header information is still available. People will argue for one of these modes or the other based on a lot of things. Tunnel mode tends to be the most secure, but has a little more overhead, because of course you're having to reproduce all the packet headers and all that stuff, because the original packets being encrypted, packet header and all. And so, but the end result is, when you use IPsec, you've got basically the most bulletproof secure connection between two points you can have. whether it's for your VPN or most commonly, this is the way you set up a tunnel between two offices so that you can transfer files and email and all the junk that you do every day at work and know that, that your office in Dubuque is safely transferring it to your office in San Francisco and no one sniffing the wire along the way gets to see anything. All right, so I think this is a good place to stop. We kind of, this is the basic introduction to all the crypto pieces. We're going to start playing with more of the options of things you can do with it. So why don't we take a break right now, avail yourselves of the coffee and snacks outside, and let's start up again at about 10:30. None. That was back then. That was when transmission was so iffy that you weren't sure. Those bits allowed you to do a quick check on the integrity of the key without any help. I mean, parity bits date back to using cassette tapes and 300 baud modems that were used to check integrity. Well, the point of them was to check the integrity of the key when it was being sent down unreliable transmission methods.
So this key was sent forward.
Well, it may have been, or it may. The thing is, you didn't know. It could have been stored on a cassette tape. It could have been, you know, they didn't have thumb drives where the sectors already have integrity checking like they do now. How you stored data 25, 30 years ago when they first started doing this was a lot different than how they do it now. And the thing is, it was also sometimes, very often, DES keys were written on paper. And so the parity bits made sure that after somebody wrote it down, put it in a sealed envelope, had it couriered over to you, and you typed it back into the system, that everything, you had a better chance of having typed the original key back in. It was just, people did things for reasons that are historical at this point that don't even make sense to us now because our situation is so much different.
Like some versions,
is there reason being like export limitations or something like that? Is the government that made the keys smaller? No, they did that. There's 40-bit versions of DES for that.
Oh.
They thought that they could easily crack the 40-bit version if they had to. So there's a version of DES that has a lot more bits than the key, and the keys lock 2 bits and the key goes on 4 bits. And that was pretty straightforward to crack.
And if
these things
are pretty paranoid on the way how we can do manage the meter for SSL.
Okay.
And for KMS, we can also use
I was assuming in my description that the client security is there. The way to move it in the middle is basically you have to first see the system to defeat the DNS. So, because you have to go to the wrong place first. Now, the most common way to do that is to put an entry in your host's file.
Okay, I get that point. I just don't think how the client will still verify that the public key is not in his trust or whatever it is, right? So,
in the beginning, when people do point verification, you would be able to, basically the way all these work is someone will convince you to download and install something. And whether that's by a mouse over a clip, whether it came as a piece of crap that someone had already installed, they would typically write something in your host file to disable your to reroute your DNS. And so they then they could put anything they wanted for your address, and that's the way they would get you to the wrong place. They would then
capture your income and data, create the session to whatever you thought you were going to. In fact, there was a, the most common that I was telling you to, it was 15 years ago when everything was on dial-up. There were people who would offer these accelerators.
Oh, yeah.
Internet accelerators, so you download this and put it in the machine, they would guarantee your connection would be much more efficient and faster. In fact, sometimes they actually put some extra compression in there so that it did work a little better, but they were always dead, they would always do that, and they would dead end your SSL with them, so they got to work everything you did, and they were claiming that they were only doing it for marketing, and that's how they were making money, but they were basically doing statistics on where you were actually searching. They're kind of an early version of Google. But the only thing is, they promised that they weren't looking at your credit card information.
I don't know if you're going to get into this. I'm very interested in quantum resistant encryption. You mentioned that looks like the curve is very vulnerable.
Yeah, there's going to be several quantum sessions going, and there are guys who will.
I've asked you before, like, how do you know that you have quantum resistant algorithms? How do you satisfy that at this point? Are you made a statement that almost all algorithms are incredible?
A lot of them are, like I said, okay. Certain algorithms lend themselves to cracking because of the things that quantum computing are good at.
Yes.
Some are not. So for example, it appears as though factoring is not something quantum is especially good at. So it does accelerate factoring because it's just faster. But that's why they brought back 4096 RSA, because they figured that if you're using 4096, that makes up for the speed improvement that you get by using quantum. But the thing is, factoring itself is not inherently accelerated by methods of quantum, but the thing is, apparently cracking the curve, it's something about those particular kinds of calculations, quantum is especially good.
Sure, right. I'm
aware of one of the guys who know that stuff, but I'll be honest, at that level, I don't. That's, I'm not a mathematician.
Do you understand what this quantum do you understand the math behind that?
No.
Neither do I. And I've said there's books that are like 3 books you have to go through to understand it. Yeah. Why would I do that?
But most of my life is trying to play with fixed commentary community, UCAPA, GPA, CPA, and NATO at the same time while helping the guys who don't know anything about hardware security and temporal labels and all that stuff do that, because that's part. Physical security is actually a special.
But when people talk about some quantum state algorithm, that's a mystery. It seems like a handful of people in the world understand.
Yeah, but I'm not one of them.
Okay. Well, that's very reassuring.
You're confused about the problems and Charles, but it's just especially targeted for computational computation.
Absolutely.
Charles.
This is
Charles.
Charles?
Yeah.
I don't know the name. I'll be honest, I have not followed the quantum stuff that much. I'm only looking at it from a studies perspective. I really don't. Okay. So I am not able to do it.
So you have to.
Hi,
Andrew.
Thanks
So yeah, if that one for RSA and reversing the curve is going to be able to find a chance back on the curve backwards. And those are the ones we're not aware of. Personally, probably One of my old colleagues would be hoping to do that through the popular, very Sean Smith at he's one of my old colleagues from my view, and he runs the security PhD program at the time. So he, and I know he's got guys with IFD on the line, so he might be a good person for the class. See, he's telling me that.
Sean Smith.
Okay. He's a good guy. He's been doing this for years. Like I said, he's got a PhD program going, so he was talking to me about that.
Oh, I have a question.
Did you mention
Mr. Coulter's
report?
Wait, I mean, I think Foster's on Amazon or something.
Is that for Apple? When you're making the connection, as soon as you see HTTPS and something on your screen, it's already done.
It's already done.
So that basically what happens is you type in Amazon.com and it's, you hit enter and it's HTTP. Mm-hmm. And then there's going to be some branding all of a sudden that'll change it as a HTTPS slide over to see the watching for it. And then if for whatever reason it can't find this, or if you go to some site, like for example, go to DISA.mil.gov, or DISA.mil.gov, or if you go to the DISA government site, they're not on any of the regular CAs. So the first thing that's going to happen is you're going to get to one in your browser saying your certificate didn't check out. So that's the one site that you can go to that will always flash up.
Yeah. Okay.
And depending upon which browser, but if you're using IMAP, it's impossible to get past it. Because they're like, this is bad, don't go there.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you missed the illness and the disease, right?
cards and I go in and turn on my flight and I go, oh, it's not free from the pilot's street. Did you do that now?
Okay, so now that we understand a little bit about what cryptography is and what some of the algorithms are and what some of the protocols are, let's go into a little more of the details and a little bit of depth. Okay, so what we know is there are really three kinds of cryptographic algorithms we use. They're symmetric, there are the asymmetric public key algorithms, and then we have hashes and MAC for doing integrity checking. And the Macs, we'll get into those in a minute, they also do some authentication along with the integrity checking, but that's basically key-based. So AES is the algorithm of choice these days, and you still can use TripleDES, like I said, and in a discussion during the break, I had said TripleDES has 168-bit key, and it does, but it's really only regarded as 112 bits of cryptographic strength, which is the minimum that is currently endorsed by CMVP. And basically, if you're doing things with common criteria in NIAP, you might as well just forget about using it. In fact, in general, I would say that unless you had to use TripleDES, don't use it.
TripleDES isn't allowed for CC.
Right, it's not allowed for CC, it's allowed for FIPS. So a lot of people still validate it under CAVs, but they don't use it. And certainly if you're doing anything with common criteria, you don't use it. But the thing is, all of these crypto algorithms, all of these symmetric crypto algorithms have modes, and these modes help the algorithm be more efficient or more useful for certain special types of applications. For example, the most basic mode for a block algorithm is called electronic codebook, and that's simply each and every block cipher is an individual. You take one block of plain text, you take one key, you run it through the algorithm, you get out the cipher text, you're done. There is no connection or interaction with any other block of data that you encrypt or decrypt. Now, that is good because you could do random access. So for example, if this was a disk file, I could go grab any single block and I can decrypt it. Well, that's good, but there's a problem. If I'm using the same key, any two blocks with the same data give you the same ciphertext. So that gives information. So for example, if I was doing a disk often has a lot of all zeros. I may end up finding out that you know, I know how much of my disk is used by mapping what the output of the blocks are and things like that. So I'm giving information away. So electronic codebook's not great for all uses. So that brings to the simplest improvement, which is called cipher block chaining. Cipher block chaining is simply saying that I'm taking my ciphertext and I am, by the way, there's three parts. Let's back up a little bit here. There's also an initialization vector, and that's usually you take your data, it's combined with the IV, and that's what's encrypted. So that's added in this one here. So the thing is, if I'm doing, this is also, I'm going backwards, this is decryption, not encryption. I figure I'm mixing things up a little bit. But the basic thing is, in cipher block chaining, I'm taking my ciphertext and I'm combining it with my plain text for the next block. So that way, even if I'm encrypting 100 blocks of zeros in a row, all the blocks are going to be different because I'm taking the previous ciphertext, I'm combining it with my new input, and then I'm encrypting it, or I'm taking my last decrypted text, combining it with my data, and then decrypting it. So the thing is, what I end up doing is they're linked, which means I can't random access anymore. So if it's a disk file and I want to get the middle of it, I have to work my way all the way down. That's bad. And we'll find other ways around that too. But the good part is it means I can encrypt data that may have repeating data and it won't show. So you're improving the secrecy. Okay, so next is counter mode. Counter mode's handy because it fixes the problem of random access and while still retaining the fix for the problem of common data, of having the same data over multiple blocks. Basically, I am going to take the IV, this data that I'm combining with my plain text, and instead of using one IV or using my previous crypto, I'm going to use a my previous encrypted data, I am going to use some data that I know I can reproduce and that I can point to a particular block. So the first part is, typically you use part of the IV is going to be a nonce, just some random data you create for the purpose and remember, because counters are expensive. Having, especially when they roll over, it's sometimes hard to have, a big counter can be expensive, especially in hardware. So typically you don't have the counter be the full length of the IV. Also, that tends to give information away if you do. So you tend to split the IV into half and do half as a nonce and half as a counter. That's a common way of doing it. So the thing is, notice that my first block, my counter is zero. My second block, the counter is one. Second block, the counter is two, and so on. But the nonce remains constant. So what that allows me to do is random access, because I know if I'm looking up the 135th block, I'm going to take that nonce, I'm going to concatenate it with 135, and use that as the IV with the same key to decrypt that block, and I'll get it. So the thing is, this was originally envisioned for things like random access, like disks and databases, and it's still used pretty commonly in databases. Disks have proven to have other interesting issues, and we'll get to, I'll mention one of the other modes of AES that's commonly used for disks, but counter mode is very valuable, and there are versions of counter mode that are also used for a lot for data transmission over networks, and we'll get to that in just a second. And in fact, here we are. Wait, did that twice? Nope, that's right. Okay, so there are special counter modes, and these are called authenticating counter modes, because what they do is, in addition to looking from here up like a regular counter, they also take the data and do an authentication process on it and end up with an off tag. And the thing is, so basically what you're doing is you are both enciphering and authenticating your data in one step. So the thing is, this is especially useful for network transmission, because you're checking your data as well as encrypting it. And so Galois counter mode, GCM, is very common. The other one, which is most commonly now used, 802.11i Wi-Fi with WPA2, is AES CCM mode. And again, same thing. You're doing a counter mode type of encryption, but then at the end, you're going back and you're doing basically a tag based on, okay, the simplest way to do one of these is if you just take AES or DES and you encrypt all the data and throw all the data away and keep the last block, that looks just like a keyed hash. So it's like a SHA-hash except it's done with a key. This is another way of doing that. It's very commonly used now for network stuff. So your data is both authenticated and encrypted and decrypted at the same time. So you end up with a greater level of security and integrity than you would have without the authentication mechanism.
So are you saying all the equipment or everything is dual encrypted?
Not dual encrypted. They're keeping other information about it, typically either a hash of part of the data, which is a running thing, or they're looking at the last block and comparing it. So the thing is, you either keep a running hash of the data, or of the encrypted data, or you're basically looking at the last block. Or there are a bunch of methods. There's also, you know, methods where you're using just a keyed hash. But these are basically, so you're doing the integrity check along with the cryptography. Okay, so there's other modes. Output feedback is pretty much no longer used, along with cipher feedback. They were mostly streaming methods that were used kind of more like Oh, for stuff, if anyone knew the things like STU3 telephones or streaming encryption over telephony, they were kind of more common for that than I think they are for anything else now. XTS is great just for the name, because it's XEX-based tweaked codebook mode with ciphertext stealing. That's the one that's turned out to be the most popular for disk encryption. So XTS mode is what's normally used on encrypted disks. Okay, so let's look at hashes for a second and see what else we can do with those. Okay, so hashing creates a unique signature for a block of data, and anyone can create the same hash with the same data, and that's how you verify integrity, like checking to make sure your newly downloaded something is exactly what you thought you were getting without the malware added. For those of you who haven't been watching the news for the past couple days, there's some new malware out, ransomware. It's really nice. The funniest thing is, here I was talking before about banking not wanting to use validated cryptography and voting systems not using validated cryptography. I don't know if I'd like to tell you this or not like to tell you this, but almost all of the ransomware uses approved cryptography. So right now, so if you download something and it turns out not to be what you thought you were downloading, it installs in your machine, and all of a sudden your screen gets that picture you've been seeing in the paper lately or on the news, that they've just encrypted all the files on your disk. They're using AES, so you're not going to get your data back. And since everyone's recommended not paying the ransom, I hope you backed up last week. But okay, so for hashes, SHA is the most common. Now, HMAC is another method where you concatenate a key with a message, hash the result, and so you end up with a keyed hash. But the key's getting combined with the data. And then there's CMAC that uses basically the key as your extra piece, and you're actually just spinning the encryption, throwing all the data away, and keeping your last block as your auth code. And so HMAC, basically, you're just concatenating the key with the data. But since the key is adding to the data, and hashes have such a good avalanche factor, that by putting this extra data on the front, this key data on the front of your data, you're completely making it, the hash is completely different as it would be without it. So the key is now necessary, which means only someone who knows the key can produce that HMAC. So it's a secret hash, and only the person who knows the secret can verify the hash. CMAC is again using the key, but this is basically just spinning the cryptography and throwing away all the data, keeping the last block. And the DESMAC was actually the oldest version of that, and used to be used a while back, and was actually kind of still used for a while longer than DES was. But again, now everyone uses AES. Okay, SHA is the oldest one. It's an approved hash function. Okay, it is keyless. So it's designed for anyone being able to verify the integrity of a block of data. SHA-1 is the original. They've discovered some weaknesses in it. It's still allowed to be used as a hash function, but it's no longer allowed under FIPS or Common Criteria to be used as part of a signature. So it's losing value. It's still around. You can still decrypt signatures with it as legacy, but SHA-1's kind of going away. SHA-224, 256, not 356. 384 and 512 are the most common, with SHA-256 commonly really being the one everyone uses most of the time. SHA-3 is a new hash algorithm. A lot of people just call SHA-224 through 512 SHA-2, as opposed, so there's SHA-1, SHA-2, and SHA-3. SHA-3 is not the same algorithm as the others. It was created for diversity so that one of the things especially NSA likes is to have different algorithms so that you can encrypt or hash or do something two different ways and make a comparison. So the thing is, they want diversity. They don't, in fact, for example, if you, NIAP prefers not having everybody use the same library, so everyone using OpenSSL all the time does not make them happy, because any vulnerability found in OpenSSL is, everybody's got that vulnerability. So that's part of why SHA-3 was developed, is just for diversity. They want equally strong but different algorithms that hopefully if they find a vulnerability in one, it won't exist in the other. So that's kind of looking forward a little bit. This is a little more at the max. So these are, you know, HMAX and MAX, and the thing is here you're showing that basically for an HMAX, you're combining the key plus the data and you're padding, and then you hash it. So the thing is, by doing this, and you may also be using an ID if you're using a crypto algorithm for doing the hashing. So by doing that, you're adding extra material to your data, so that the thing is, you have secrets involved in doing the hash, and so reproducing the hash takes the knowledge of the secret. And so that's the big difference. That's not intended for anyone to be able to verify the data. Only the people you intend to can verify the data. MAC is, you know, CMAC is kind of the easiest, because basically you're just saying, take all the data, save the M, throw away everything until you got there. Very expensive, but very secure. Okay, now signatures, this is the one we use all the time. So this comes with, this is typically how, especially under FIPS 140, if your module allows code update, you have to sign your code. If you know, people sign messages, if you're using SMIMAIL, we'll get to that, you know, you're gonna sign the message. So, and basically what you're doing is, signature generation is you hash the data, you end up with the digest, which is the output. You then encrypt that with a private key, generate a standard 509 signature, which we'll get to in a little bit, and then you send that. And then the reverse process is you then hash your data, you get the message digest, you run it through the public key version of it, and if it all matches, bingo, you win. You've got exactly what they sent. If it doesn't, you've got bogus data. So now that we've got all these tools, I'm going to just go through a bunch of common use scenarios, and the fairly simple, straightforward ones that you do all the time, some starting without cryptography, adding cryptography, and seeing what you get at each stage. So for example, this is connect to Wi-Fi, like right here in the hotel. Turn on the Wi-Fi, you look for an access point, connect with no authentication or encryption, and you hope you're connected to the internet, because you may be connected to the guy with the Wi-Fi router in the room next to yours. So you're sharing your data with anyone who's listening. And by the way, even if you are connected to the hotel, if someone's got a Wi-Fi access point in the next room, a sniffer, set up as a sniffer, they can still cop all your data and anything that isn't running, you know, so if you're running a VPN to work, that's safe, or you've actually got an SSL or TLS session running to Amazon, that's safe. But if you're running something that isn't HTTPS, you're sharing it with everybody. And, well, I don't know, depending on what data you have and how you maintain it, that may or may not be an issue. But remember, you're far more publicized than you think you are. Okay, so here's slightly better. You turn on the Wi-Fi, you look for an access point. Like for example, let's take in the airline lounge at the airport. It says, okay, here's the access point, the SSID. So you go connect to that, and then you use one of the accepted protocols. You know, WEP is now deprecated. You really don't want to use that anymore. That's kind of ancient, but you know, WPA is also deprecated. There were problems with that. So hopefully you're using WPA2. And chances are, if they've put the key on there, you're using PSK, which is pre-shared key. And chances are, it's a decent connection. And you, but you still hope you're connected to the internet, and if anyone was listening and got in the way, you are sharing your data with them. But much less of a possibility. I mean, and especially like if this is the way you set up at home, where you know, okay, so we're here, you know your SSID. It's a particular SSID that you set in your router. You connect with a pre-shared key, so you type the key into the router and you type the key into your laptop, or you know, in your, if you have a small office, you may do it the same thing. You connect. This is probably pretty safe. And the thing is, this really should be the baseline. Now, on the other hand, we all connect in airports and hotels, or at least most of us do, which is where the, you know, going back from the IPsec stuff, the VPN comes in. You really should use a VPN to connect to any important data. You really should make sure that, you know, you've got a good TLS connection with your own certificate to anyone you're putting your credit card into, because otherwise you are broadcasting that for everybody and everything. Now the enterprise version. This is when you're in the building at work and IT set up your connection. So you look for a particular access point, you connect with a certificate that was given to you, and you're authenticated via RADIUS server, and you're definitely connected now, and you're not sharing your data with anyone who you shouldn't be. And so this is the corporate type of, so basically, home or small office with a pre-shared key, or enterprise with a certificate. This is, now the thing is, this is where you're using cryptography to set up and secure your connection. You're using either a pre-shared key, which is delivered to you out of band. You know, you look at one screen, you look at another screen. So if you're doing it at home, you're doing it yourself. If you're doing it at a friend's house, they scribbled it on a piece of paper and handed it to you. Or if they memorized it, they tell it to you while you're typing it in. You're fairly secure then. But if you know, do realize that here at the hotel and when you're at the airport, your data is not really secure unless you're connecting to one of the services where you do have a pre-shared key or something, or you do have an authentication. And for example, some of them you'll connect via a public channel, and then they'll redirect you and bounce you over to the private encrypted channel. Those are okay, but be aware that otherwise people are seeing your data. Okay, let's say I want to send a secret message to somebody. Now, I've done this with people. I do this with some of the labs I work with. I've done it with coworkers when we didn't have encrypted mail. First, you got to get an encryption program, and you can download a million of those off the internet. You create a key, hopefully using a good random number generator. I haven't even talked about random number generation. That's good for another 3 hours all by itself. And certainly if you talk to either CMVP or NIAP, they'll probably stretch that to 2 weeks and not come up with an answer. Random numbers are much, much harder than most people give them due for. Creating good random numbers is hard, though on the other hand, even a bad random number created secretly is better than a good random number created in public. And I think that's what some of the standards organizations fail to formally recognize. And that's a lot of the problem with stuff that uses DevRandom and things like that. But you create a key and you encrypt the message. You know, you can use a command line, or there are drag and drop programs and all this stuff. You get the key to the recipient out of band. And that's the hard part. How do you deliver the key? You can write it down on a piece of paper and mail it to them. The U.S. mail's pretty secure. You can fax it to them. You could read it to them over the phone. I've even done stuff where it was kind of an emergency and real short term, where you send the data from one email account and the key from another email account, that someone would have to trap both emails to be able to find out the message. If you're really paranoid, that's no good. If you're, you know, only a little bit paranoid, that helps a little bit, or for a short term, it's okay. If the message has a very limited time value. But, and then you send, you know, you send this and the person decrypts it. This is, this technique works. This is kind of like the same as the using a book code. You know, as long as you're both using the same version of the book, you're fine. This is a very simple way to send a secret message, and it's actually, you can find programs on the internet that'll do the encryption and decryption for you for free. You know, they're probably even open source, so they may actually be reliable and not have any backdoors or tricks in them. Now let's talk about the internet shopping version of this, because your secret message is now your credit card. So you connect via HTTPS to the web server with your browser. And you better look at that. You should always look when you're doing shopping or stuff like that. Up in the corner, there'll be a little lock symbol, and it'll say HTTPS instead of HTTP. Important little thing most people don't think about. Okay, under the cover, your browser creates the SSL or TLS session, because, again, nothing has to be out of band on this, because using public key cryptography, they create a shared secret and then create the session key without anything going across in the open that you have to worry about. That's the advantage of the crypto protocol. And if you're using TLS, you even can have a fairly strong belief that the person you're talking to is the person you think you're talking to, and that the things you order off of Amazon will be there the day after tomorrow. So you send the message, you're ordering your credit card number, and hopefully they will ship you your new thing, whatever that is. Again, you've used, going all the way back, you've just used TLS in a very everyday manner, the way that, you know, millions of people every day shop on this, and most of the time it's perfectly good. Okay, so let's talk about email. Say you want to send email that you don't want people to be able to look at, that only your recipient should see. So the first thing is you need to get a certificate, because you have to be able to encrypt that email. And so there are a lot of ways of encrypting email. For example, you can go buy a copy of PGP, and you can use that to generate your keys. You can go to Thought or one of the others and get an S/MIME certificate, which installs in your system automatically in both your browser and your email program, or in basically your computer's certificate store, unless you're using Firefox and it keeps its own certificate store. So if you go get a certificate and install it in a Firefox, unless you specifically move it over, it's not going to be available to Internet Explorer or Chrome or Windows, depending on how you did this, depending on how they installed it. Firefox keeps its own certificate store. So the thing is, you go through the process of buying the certificate so that now you have a certificate on the internet. You can be checked. And so you get the certificate, it's referenced, it's set to your program, and the first thing you do is you send a signed message without your secret junk to the person you expect to receive it, and that way they get your public key and they can install the public key. In fact, with S/MIME, that's pretty much automatic. When you send a signed message, the key is automatically added to your key collection. So then, the next time after that person says, okay, got it, you click encrypt on your email. Some actually show it to you, that all of a sudden the email becomes just a bunch of junk. Some do it behind the covers. But that email goes, the S/MIME has some flaws in it. It is not the best system, but it works. And in most cases, the person who gets your mail is going to be the only person who gets your mail. If you use PGP, the mail is actually encrypted outside of your program and stuffed back in. You know, and so that's slightly better. And then there's, you know, you can buy from a number of the commercial Norton, and so I also have, I'm assuming you guys do too? You don't? Okay, Norton has secure email, but they all do the same thing. They're using a certificate to encrypt the symmetric key, the AES key, used to encrypt your mail message, and that you've already sent a message to someone that's given them your public key. And that's how the whole thing, and so that way they're able to decrypt the mail. And they can do, you can do this with even a bunch of people, because they can encrypt, they can set a bunch of encryption headers on there with the public key of different people. So sometimes you may if you send it to 15 different people, they're going to be 15 different public key signatures of that AES key attached to the mail, so each person can decrypt it with, each person decrypts the AES key with their certificate, and that way they can then decrypt the message. And so that's one of those things. Most people have no idea how secure mail works, but it's just using the same kind of protocol techniques that we've been talking about all morning. Then there's the IPsec version. Now, assuming that you're on your corporate network and you're home, so you crank it up and you use some VPN program to connect to the office, and you crank up your email program and you send mail, it's going down the encrypted tunnel, so it's not exposed on the internet. Now, if it's going to someone outside of your organization, it may end up going back out on the internet and being exposed. So if you are VPN'd, if you don't separately encrypt your mail using S/MIME or whatever your company uses to encrypt mail, you still may be sending, if that goes back out of the company, you still may be sending email to someone in the clear. So be aware that even using some of the best security available, you still have to look at the context under which it's being used, and is it protecting your data all the way to its final destination? It may be, it may not be. Okay, this is one I've been mentioned a bunch of times, updating your firmware. And so this is whether it's the firmware for your printer, your router. Now, step back for a second. People may say, oh, well, who cares about, you know, I'm really going to worry about my printer. Well, if you remember about 3 months ago, there was an enormous DDoS, distributed denial of service attack on the internet in Northeast U.S. And the vast majority of devices that perpetrated this attack were webcams that all had firmware that had been updated with malware in it, and that malware at a particular day and time started hammering the hell out of certain websites. And that's what a distributed denial of service attack is. It's basically, and the thing is, you've all probably heard the term zombie computers. It's when you accidentally download some malware and there's a little piece of code running in your machine resident that at a particular day and time just starts bashing some website. That's what a zombie is. And so the thing is, they turn a bunch of printers and webcams and stuff into zombies and use them to do these attacks. So the thing is, it really does matter what you're downloading and upgrading with. So this is why, especially stuff under FIPS 140, the code has to be signed. So the thing is, because again, if it's just hashed, someone can fake the hash value, you know, where when you download it, they can put the wrong value for you to download along with the firmware. Or most people, even if most people never check that. If they have, you know, how many times have you gone to a website where it says, okay, here's the code update, here's the hash. You download the code, you install it. Didn't do the hash check. Very few people, unless it's built into the code or built into the hardware where it actually goes and gets the hash and does the hash check itself, or the hash is embedded in the code cryptographically, nobody does that. And so you really do need to be more careful with this sort of thing. And again, this is the cryptographic method. Certainly if it's FIPS 140, this is how it goes. Well, here I'm saying the code is hashed locally. Yes, it is. If it's done under FIPS 140, it's actually that hash has been delivered, encrypted by an RSA certificate, and you decrypt the certificate and get the hash value back from there, run the hash, so you know that everything's good and no one's substituted the hash value. So these are, again, cryptographic protections for stuff you do all the time that most people don't follow, and here's a, and that DDoS attack a couple months ago was a perfect example of stuff getting updated without being checked. So I'm actually running a little, in fact, I'm running a lot early, and I apologize, but that'll give you guys a chance to do some other stuff this morning. Cryptography is one of the main tools we use to achieve security. It's just a tool. Cryptography is not security. Effective use of cryptography helps create security. So that's the first thing. The tool isn't the end result. The tool is how you can get to the end result if you do it correctly by using good algorithms, by using good vetted protocols, and by following all the good techniques. You know, don't cheat along the way. Make sure everything's set up right. When you're doing the configuration, follow all the steps. It's complicated. The science behind the cryptography is complicated, and it can be sometimes that the setup and verification of all the stuff can be complicated. If you don't follow all the rules, don't be surprised and don't blame it on anyone else when it doesn't work. Unless this is your chosen field and you're a math major or someone working with cryptography, chances are you don't understand all this stuff. And that's okay. You don't understand everything about how your car works or how the rocket that went to the moon works, but you still, you know, you can use these tools. You know, you use your car, you use your television, you use your computer, even without understanding about how it all works, but you understand that for your car to work, you have to put gas in the tank, oil in the engine, key in the ignition, step on the gas, step on the brake, all that other stuff. You can use cryptography correctly as long as you follow the instructions. And so you need to do that. And like I said, I had to accept that too. I'm not a mathematician, I'm a hardware designer. but along the way, and designing a few crypto chips and things like that, you know, I understand the function and how it works, but I don't understand all the math. That's okay. You know, if you're one of the people who needs to, you better go to school. But if that's not what your job is, just understand what you need to do to make it work correctly, and don't skip the steps. That's what your responsibility is. But basic understanding of the kind of stuff I've gone over today, and I've done it pretty lightly, you know, this is going to help get you started. But when you're doing these things, please go look it up, go find out what you need to know. You know, look at the RFCs, use the latest versions. You know, we're still fighting with people who want to use TLS 1.0 because they're using XP. You know, there are still people using XP as their primary systems, and they haven't upgraded, and there have been no security patches in 6 years now, 7 years, and the browsers still barely support TLS 1.0, and they won't upgrade. Well, that's not going to help, and whether it's you communicating with them or you trying to sell them your products, they're going to have security problems. You know, so you have to get with the program and stay current. And if you know some of the stuff, you can amaze your friends at parties. I don't know. These are some good books that are, well, The Codebreakers is just kind of interesting to read. Handbook of Applied Cryptography and Applied Cryptography by, you know, the Menzies, Van Aarschot and Van Stone and Schneer's book are really, they're starting to get out of date. They're 6 or 8 years old now, I think. I don't think there's been a new version recently, but they're still pretty much the standard. On the other hand, you know, it's, the web's great. Yeah, you have to make sure. I would say that don't take the first answer you get for anything, because a lot of times people put up BS. But you can learn just about everything you need to know about cryptography just by Googling and reading. And it gets to be an extra exercise about spotting the ones that are wrong. You know, it's one. I remember once going through an example in Menzies and spending about 4 hours working my way through a thing on the internals of SHA and going, wait, that doesn't add up. There's something wrong here. And I went to the website and found an errata and actually found that, yeah, I had found a mistake in the book that other people had found, but I wasn't the first person, but there was a mistake. So the thing is, sometimes applying yourself to one of these exercises is worth the trouble. helps, you know, verify that you actually understand what you're doing, and going through the web, and if something doesn't make sense, going and looking that up and seeing if you're right or wrong is kind of, you know, a good impromptu self-test about whether you actually understand some of this stuff. Never hurts. Okay, like I said, I am early. I apologize and I don't apologize. I think if anyone wants to ask questions, I will be available for as long as you'd want. Please enjoy ICMC. This is our fourth year. It's our biggest ever. I've helped plan the first one, and I've been involved in all the ones since, and I think this is getting to be a really good conference, and I hope you all enjoy it. Thank you. Sir.
A lot of us use two-factor authentication for cell phones. Sometimes when it's at Google or at some hotel, it sends it through, sends us a key to our a text to our cell phone. There was a recent article I read that there's a significant vulnerability with receiving that, say, six-digit key to texting. That real?
I haven't.
It's with the SS7 switches. It's an old vulnerability. You can redirect some of these text messages to your phone.
Oh, okay.
It was actually exploited recently.
Okay. Because, I mean, the intent is good. They're sending an out-of-band message. But if there's a way to redirect it, then obviously they're defeating the purpose. So
that take extra effort, so it's better than...
Yeah. I mean, because some of them send emails, some of them... The text has gotten to be really, really common now. The other one that works better is in, like, the Microsoft tool that does that. It sends something to your phone, but then it's decrypted. Like, it's sending a message to your phone, which is decrypted, and then you get a four-digit code up on the screen, which you then type back in. But the thing is, it was sent to your phone encrypted. So I guess that one's okay, because if it gets redirected and they don't have your installed copy of the application with your personal key in there, they won't get the right four-digit code back. So I'm trying to remember, it's like, hang on, I should be able to look. It's just called Microsoft Authenticator. I know some apps use that. I mean, Roku uses it. If you have locked channels on your Roku, that's become very common with if they use the Roku channel development system. But that's one way that's a little more secure, that it actually sends an encrypted message to you. But it is sending it by out of band. It's sending it by a different.
It's going to the same device, right?
Well, it's going to the same device, but the path's different. Well, that helps some.
But how? If I'm holding the phone and I did whatever the action is, that's now prompting me to put in the second factor. But the second factor is coming to the phone, which I'm obviously holding, and it's obviously unlocked. It sends 67 second factors. And
right. I mean, they're assuming that you're holding the phone and you unlocked it. They're putting that responsibility. But if so,
the second factor isn't really.
Well, it depends. If someone tried to get to it from anywhere else but your phone, it wouldn't come back to you.
Correct.
So that's still providing value. Well, because the assumption is someone tried to. I mean, I've never had someone try to get in as me from my phone. I've had someone try to get in as me from other things. So when they, like, it, okay, that happened to me last week. Someone tried to use my credit card. Okay, the thing about I was in a hotel and they stole my credit card because they had my, had they stolen my phone and they were making the order from my phone, they would have been successful. But they had no access to my phone. They had access to my information, and using this as the second factor was perfectly good. It prevented the fraud.
That's correct. That's correct, but it brings up some interesting points. One is now you're using second factor actually as a notification that you may have a problem, which is not how it was envisioned, right?
Well, it did both. It sent me a PIN the first time, and then it sent me the fraud notice.
Yes, the point is there verifying that you have a token? You could have a hardware token, you could have whatever.
could also access it through another computer or some other device if you wanted to.
Right. And second fact, I was envisioned to the whole point of having this.
You have a hardware device. You have that piece of equipment that they're sending the text to. I'm saying that is a second package. You're saying the second package is envisioned as having a piece of equipment that you have that somebody else doesn't have. And they're verifying that. And the fact that you're accessing a service through that device is somewhat immaterial.
You're sending the second factor to the same device from which the request for the first factor came in, then the second factor is useless.
No, it's still verifying you have that piece of equipment.
No, the point is that if somebody's stolen your phone and they're trying to access something and they says, I want to make sure it's you, I'm going to send something to that phone that is
sure. But that means that somebody now has to go steal your phone, break into your phone, and access the device and access the services. Now, if it's some guy in China this day now flies over to my house, go finds my phone, breaks in, steals my phone just so they can get access to my Amazon account, they have way too much time to do that.
I mean, for example, if they're going to do that, okay, so my phone's encrypted and locked. You know, if they're going to get into my phone to get that second factor, they've pretty much already won. So the thing is, the second factor in that case isn't stopping much, but on the other hand, it's going to stop pretty much anybody who isn't very skilled. I'll take the 90th percentile most days. Yeah, there should be better things, but then how many devices are we going to have? Yet another device? Or do we have to have we have to start carrying a PIV card separately? Yeah, do we need a...
I'd say it's banking on the fact that everybody should go back to physical tokens because that physical token guarantees that the first request didn't come from the token itself.
Right, well, that's what the military does. That's what you got a CAC card for. And now they're even changing it. It used to be that the CAC card only had to be authenticated for the certificate. Now they're starting to require that you then run that through RADIUS. So they're getting really serious that you have to have your user ID, your password, and your certificate all have to clear RADIUS.
But you're never doing that for consumer stuff, and that's the problem. So, the DOD and CAD cards, you can standardize across a large number of services and servers. Easily because they say thou shalt do this and it shall work this way. But when you're logging into eBay, you're logging into E-Trade, you're logging into Wells Fargo, they're not standardized. So that's why they're going with their own apps that are doing as best you can, because they're saying this is being authenticated and provided.
On the other hand, if we're starting to talk about valuable transactions or serious transactions, I can use one of my credit cards as the second factor. I mean, I can use I plug one of the little square readers into my phone or plug a, in fact, I wish people would do this already, because if I had a smart card reader for regular transactions and I had to go through the same thing that a vendor has to go through to sell me something, if I had to put the card into my PC, then I don't have to worry about someone,
So most PCs do have readers.
Yeah, now. Right.
That standardized, you could do
that. That would work. Would it be even better is if they actually put a pin pad on the reader so that you could actually put the pin in the reader and not have to run it through the untrusted channel of the PC, but now we're getting really complicated again.
There's a lot of interest in cybersecurity product area, the SSL, TLS, proxy middleware boxes. What's driving that, if you know, other than just
I don't know. I mean, I think probably acceleration. I'm not sure. I don't know. I haven't been exposed to that, so I haven't seen it.
So are you talking about encrypting SSL and TLS?
Yeah, approximately. You're having too many traffic.
Yes.
SSL, SSL TLS traffic, you want to look at that before you let it come into your network. So you basically said it's a well, form of feedback and inspection, but not exactly. But you want to look at the traffic that's coming into your network to see if there's malware. So there's a almost all the cybersecurity companies are developing those products. There's a demand for those products that they're trying to understand. So is it just the increased encrypted traffic coming in, or is there some other factor?
So there's two use cases that I've seen. The first case would be incoming traffic in your network where you're running a bunch of web servers.
Yeah.
And what I've seen there is it's for efficiency, it's for being able to scan the stuff that you have your web servers behind that don't necessarily all have to load balancing where you're going through and you have a point that is doing service handling the crypto and you don't have to have all your web servers handling it all by themselves. The other use case I've seen is outgrowing where you want to look at user data for exploitation reasons or whatever. The downside to cryptography is now we have a pipe that's going through your network that you don't know what's in it, and it can take whatever people want. Just because it's going across four doesn't mean that it's actually HTTPS. And so a large number of organizations want to be able to ensure that people aren't sending stuff out that they shouldn't be.
That would be the government application. Government corporation and pretty much anybody that's worried about IP or any other sort of information that can come out.
Companies or organizations have some legal liability.
And
there's any number of different reasons. If somebody's doing something bad on your network and you don't stop them, the problem with that is that there are ways to make that really, really difficult to do. And then also, even in some European countries, if you actually take a look at some of that data, you now have some other privacy legal obligations. If somebody's going to their bank and you're now giving them all the data that goes across, you now have to open yourself up to some issues. So the man in the middle boxes in IOC are put there for specific applications a large. As Steve mentioned, publicly or asymmetric operations are really expensive. And so you can get hardware acceleration or other tools on those specialized boxes to allow you to get more connections than you otherwise would.
Any other questions?
You mentioned SHA-1. Having weaknesses.
Expand exactly
what you mean by weaknesses.
There's some collision issues, there's some other stuff. Basically, I can't give you the exact fine detail of it. I just Google it. Just Google SHA-1 weakness, and the thing is, it's really minor. I can tell you that it's minor enough that you're still allowed to use SHA-1 as a hash. It's just for some reason they have decided to no longer allow it to be used in signatures.
Actually, Google Inc. is the best way because the Google team was the one that actually implemented proof of concept for Shedder attack recently. So you can just Google Shedder and you will see the attack, proof of concept, description of how they build it, and basically it's quite big.
Two different PDF files, right?
Yeah.
Both come up with the same SHA-1 hash or collision.
And the second PDF file is generated by Google groups, any content.
I mean, you have to have collisions by definition because the thing is, you've only got so many bits in the output, and you've got an infinite number of things you can run through it. So the point is, yes, you will have collisions. And it's based on the algorithm, is there a weakness that collisions happen more often than they have to statistically? And apparently the answer for SHA-1 is yes, by some number, but it's not significantly bad because they haven't completely deprecated it. They've just said, don't use it for certain things. And the joke is why they allow it to be used for hashing and not signatures is a complete mystery to me.
Oh, actually, can explain. Is that actually two different types of exploits for hashes? One is secondary image. So you have
You don't have the hash to compare to since it's hidden.
Well, one attack is you have like stem reduced size, and you can generate a second message that would have the same stem. And the second attack is you can generate two different messages which will have the same stem. So when one attack is more complicated and has way more users, like you already have stems that somebody else has used, and you generate your own message for that same stem. And this attack is not proven for SHA-1, so there's no way to build it. But the second attack, where you take two custom messages that you generate, and they will both have the same SHA-1, that attack can be built.
But the interesting thing is, see, if you're talking about that, but in the signature case, the SHA is hidden to, it's hidden. So the thing is, if you don't have the correct key to look at the hash, you don't even get to see it. So the thing is, I mean, the likelihood of someone being able to put a duplicate copy of different firmware, like my tech, and being able to make it collide, that's a lot of work.
Well, the problem here is that you can generate two certificates, one that will look harmless, and the one that you can use for like generating new certificates, and sign one using certificate authority, and then use the second one. So certificate authority thinks that they can sign your non-malicious certificate. And in fact, you can then generate that signature to use your second malicious certificate to sign other certificates. So the attacker can generate two certificates, one that doesn't look bad and one that looks suspicious. Send one to certificate authority and get signature, and use that signature for the second certificate. And that is bad.
So it's still not what you'd call an easy attack.
Not trivial.
So it's not trivial, but it's bad if it is performed.
Yeah, so SHA-1 is already deprecated for Google and its proof of concept. What the problem is right now is it is getting computationally feasible for people to go through and start manufacturing collisions even before Google demonstrated. The problem with Google's proof of concept is it took them a year on some 64,000 GPUs, which turns out to be a whole lot of computing time. So the realistic thing is right now SHA is probably okay for most applications. People are just being very cautious about digital signatures because, as was pointed out, that's underpinning the smaller certificates and PKIs. Passed around. So if somebody could manufacture a certificate, he didn't manufacture, but create a rogue certificate like they did with Microsoft's not too long ago, then we have a lot of problems. So in general, SHA-1 is okay, or probably okay, for the most, it just takes too long to do it today.
I guess I'm mostly just surprised that they didn't just deprecate the whole thing rather than...
Because it's not bad. I mean, the reality is when it takes you a year on millions of dollars worth of hardware, most people are, Joe Blow or some little kid in his basement is not going to go around building it. When you can start going on AWS and rent out a bunch of machines for, $5,000 and it only takes you a week, that's a big problem.
Yeah. That's
and much that's where it's going, right?
And well, they tried deprecating it. It was just too hard.
No one wants. It's kind of like deprecating.
There's old browsers that don't support it, and then also those payment terminals. I mean, those cheap ones that you find at the corner grocery or whatever.
Yeah.
Millions of them. They're just baked in. They don't want to change them all.
But they all have to be FIPS, so.
Well, I don't know why I'm doing there. It's the same chip.
Interesting.
So as long as you aren't generating new certificates or you aren't generating new signatures, you're okay. So SHA-1 still good for legacy use.
Yeah.
So Microsoft deprecated a lot of the most libraries you're going to.
Well, they can access anything that they can find an opening for. So, for example, if you have any shared, if you have anything that's shared and they can either you don't have it locked, like if you have everyone set with read access and you've got a share, they could take it. If you have any open vulnerabilities, they could try to exploit them. So no, it's not like your machine is suddenly just sitting there wide open. It's no different than it is on any other network, but the point is you're now on a hostile network as opposed to hopefully at home or at work you're on a benign network.
And do VPNs protect you from that?
Well, the VPN only protects the data you send. So for example, if your machine is properly locked down, you have no open ports except, the firewall set up correctly so that no one can initiate an external query into your machine. It can only be a response to a query you've made, blah, 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 all that stuff. If you VPN it, then nothing going up or down the hose is visible, and you don't have, you have a brick wall showing that there's nothing they can get into. So that's the thing. If you have a properly locked down machine and you're using VPN and it's not split tunnel, because the problem is the default way most people set up their VPNs is anything going to an address on the VPN goes through the tunnel, but anything going to anywhere else to save performance, because otherwise, let's say you wanted to just do some web surfing and you're in the hotel and you're on your work laptop, and work allows that, because I won't even get into that whole thing about whether you should or shouldn't, but work allows that. And let's say you want to go to Amazon. Well, Amazon's not on your corporate network, so you're going to go around the outside. So all that's going unprotected through whatever you're connected to. Sometimes they have a much stricter thing where it's like no split tunnel. Everything's got to go down the VPN and then back out to the internet through your machine room at work, where they have better firewalls and all that other stuff, but the performance sucks. So that's, the one or the other. So the thing is, for example, most places set up with split tunnel. So if you're talking to anywhere but work, you're still possibly exposed. All right, well, thank you so much for coming. I hope this was worthwhile to you. And like I said, please enjoy ICMC. Thank you.
Lunch is at 12:20, like Bill said. Just head downstairs in all directions, but I think we're probably about 12 o'clock. 11:30, actually. We've got 40 minutes.
Oops.
Is it okay? About 50
here. I was surprised. I should have been like, that's three of us. Anyway.
Oh, that's right.
See the number. Hi, Steve. I'm Grant.
Have you seen the Coursera report that they got cryptosted with one or two to somebody else? That's about cancer.
Yeah.
So it's free, unless you want to correct it, but outside that, it's an online course. And Coursera is a company that it's online education.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them.
Yeah. It's a pretty big one. Stanford professor.
Nice. And it's pretty great. Like, people say, get off the list.
Where does
he
go?
Oh, hi.
How are you doing? So we're going to meet up on Thursday.
I'll be honest, I'm not sure that I'm going to be much of a real build.
Absolutely. Yeah, I am aware of that as well. Okay. I think it's always interesting to be objective, and I'll talk to you about
Okay. Because it's funny, we did something for the first time in 6 years. All of our regular Wi-Fi gear is all limited. You know, we do it all ourselves. We do a lot of it and computer bits, you see, everything like this. But we have a number of software in our so we actually for the first time bought a gallery version of music.
Especially in session.
It was just much easier than training to get it. It's kind of important. We have 75 hours. We don't want to have I'm actually technically on this one for you. I wrote this one again. We don't have the only one. But I've got so much going, I don't need to get in all those projects. I'm just showing the information. It's working out pretty well. Doing that with our software products that are considered as a
I was interested, you mentioned a little bit about the brand of
I used to design entrance.
Hey, okay. So then you were a little more vocal.
Sorry. Hi. Chris.
Yeah.
This is probably just not your first time hearing about this stuff.
This is actually my second time this month.
But it's also interesting. I was envisioning this last week,
so.
So
I was actually, well, first time I came, just started, and particularly the other one in Morocco, and my favorite was a lot. But it was, so, and we have a picture of the machine there. Hold on an hour. It's in here. But I have so much more education. I really find it as a leader, because we have a fair couple of questions. It basically is the same thing.
That's awesome.
It takes a good couple of months recently. You basically did an entire course.
Go ahead. Yes. I did.
Yes. So it's like, I have no method.
It was more precise, it's engine, like, all
not quite a double. And it was just like kind of a free idea. I don't know if you have been able to do it on the side, but it still happened for me to do it because people still want that. People said, you know, I wish I could get that bigger.
Oh, nice. That's actually pretty cool.
Then you have to go from the one to the other to the soap, and you have to keep your dollars. You have to do things. There's this dividing line somewhere between $1 and $1.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to age.
So the same thing, like, you could end up with a ton of bad.
Yeah.
I think, like, I'd rather get the one.
Yeah. Yeah.